When I first started writing my book, I was very adamant that the lens I was using to look at the world should be pointing outwards, not inwards. I had become fatigued by first-person confessional journalism, almost always from women, that delved into the secrets of our lives in order to politically interpret the world around us. White men never have to do this. I felt quite strongly that I should be taken as seriously as the middle-aged white guy writer who gets to be objective without ever having to speak about his personal life. But in this episode, I've decided to flip-flop on what I once believed, for two key reasons. The first being, once the book came out, I realised people wanted to know. They wanted to know who I was, where exactly I had come from, and how on earth a book like this one made it to publication. The second reason is more simple. My producer said I should do it. So this week, I will be in the hot seat. And I've enlisted the help of the comedian Nish Kumar, who will be our dirt digger in chief.
In this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
I call it an insurrection.
The whites have become black.
If you open your door to uncontrolled immigration from Middle Eastern countries, you are advising in terrorism.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected.
Welcome to About Race with Rennie Edo-Lodge.
So what do you describe your job as?
Author.
Author, and do you consider yourself a journalist?
Yeah, I do still say author and journalist, even though I haven't been able to get my teeth stuck into a good meaty piece of journalism for a while.
Right. Are you uncomfortable with being put in the same sort of pot as activists and politicians?
I still feel very close to my activist background. Yeah. I still try to pay attention to what's going on in activism. I'm not involved in the same way I once was. I don't think I can be in this position.
Right.
I still want a signal boost. I'm still happy to sign an open letter and give support in whatever way I can. I'm not doing activism in the way of like blocking roads or anything like that. But I always want to know what's going on in those spaces, you know? Yeah. It's been a crucial way of forming my politics, being involved in activism on the ground. I never want to become divorced from that. Before we get into where I am now, let's go back to where it all began.
So you went to stage school?
Yeah, well,
like summer school?
Yeah, I went to Sylvia Young's theatre school for, I think, maybe a week every summer for 3 years between the ages of like 11 and 14. My mum had a very lucrative market stall on Portobello Road.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so she started out just like hustling on this market stall, and then she was making enough money to send me to stage summer school.
Did you grow up around Portobello Road then?
No, so my family were in Tottenham at the time, so we'd make the early morning drive.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
What was Tottenham like?
Tottenham, well, I didn't spend too much time in and around Tottenham when I was growing up, because I went to school in Enfield.
Which is further north,
yeah,
right?
Further north, almost suburb-like. Mm. So I didn't spend too much time in Tottenham. I just sort of stayed at home and read or went on the internet.
You were in your own world.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, so,
and were you like, were you sort of bookish, academic? I'm always interested in what people were like when they were kids. Again, because a friend of mine who I've known for a long time was like, you have become the exact adult that you were always going to be. If you met me at three, you'd be like, I know exactly what this guy's going to be like when he's 32 years old, and I am not hanging around to see.
Oh, I see.
Were you like,
did your friend not hang around then?
No, my friend has hung around.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, I was very bookish. Yeah. I would say in my early childhood, by the time I met my teens, I sort of fell out of it for a bit, but I was very bookish. An early reader, I was reading. My mum was very proud to let people know that I was reading by the age of four.
Sure.
And I was reading everything I could get my hands on. That was basically like the basis of my vocabulary, reading. Yeah. And then, you know, I reached teens and adulthood and realised I was pronouncing things wrong. I think middle class people are always like quick to point it out. Oh, that's wrong. I'm like, well, I learned this word from books.
Yeah. What were you reading? What sort of things?
Oh, let's see. All your basic, well, not basic, great children's literature, you know, Philip Pullman, Roald Dahl, Jacqueline Wilson, obviously the Harry Potter books, which I was, you know,
massive decision in deciding to sign with Bloomsbury.
Yeah, of
publishers
course.
Of Harry Potter. Still haven't met J.K.
Yeah.
Maybe it will never happen.
I think that's surely inevitable.
I suppose we have to give it time.
How weird was it then that Hermione is a fan of your book?
Actually, both Hermione's.
Are they both? Have they? You've both got Hermione's. Both Hermione's.
Both Hermione's have registered their approval of the
That's
book.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
I don't know. I mean, I just, maybe I've got this like delusion of grandeur where I'm like, well, of course they would like it. You know, why wouldn't they?
When I say both Hermione's, I mean the actresses who have played Hermione. I was shocked when, in September 2017, Noma Dumezweni, who plays Hermione in the stage production of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, posted an image of my book on her Instagram. She wrote, "I can finally hear the majority of my years being articulated in a language that I can understand, helping me better articulate an experience. I want all the friends I know and love to get a copy of this book, please." A few months later, Emma Watson, who plays Hermione in the films, chose my book for her 200,000 strong Goodreads book club named Our Shared Shelf, writing, "I am not supposed to have favourites. However, this was the most important book for me this year. I had no idea that my participation in the Harry Potter fandom would ever result in this."
Did you de-nerdify as you became a teenager?
No, I think that, like, what, an only child for maybe 7.5 years. So yeah. I was very used to being lost in my own world because mm-hmm. my mom was a single parent. She was working all the time, you know, busy trying to acquire food and money for us to be able to survive. Yeah. And those first few years of the council flat, it was hard.
Yeah, yeah.
So I learned to entertain myself. And I think I'm back to that place now, like learning to entertain myself. But I think for a decent time period between, you know, my teens and then early 20s, personal relationships with other people really overtook like my interest in reading and stuff.
Sure.
And I went to an all-girls school as well.
Oh, really?
So it was like people's dramas would occupy everyone's head for an entire week. Who's arguing with you, blah, blah, blah.
It was an all-girls, was it like a Catholic school or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Was it a state school or grammar school or something?
It was a state school.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But near a few grammar schools in Enfield Town.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Were you like good grades? Hard working.
No, no, not at all. I kind of just stopped really caring, I think, particularly towards the end of my time in secondary school and sixth form. Uh-huh. I just became disillusioned. I just like, what is the point? I remember, this is going to sound silly, but it really affected me, the transition from year 7 to year 8. And yeah. I was like very used to being the top set for everything.
Yeah.
And then I was like left off a list for French classes. And so all of my friends in the top set went into, you know, top set of French, and they were also learning German. And I was boosted down to the bottom set where some people couldn't even say je m'appelle. And I was like, this is bullshit. I'm not even going to try. But, you know, I sometimes had this feeling in school of feeling underestimated.
Right, okay.
And I felt that was very demotivating.
Sure.
I remember feeling that in primary school as well. But I was also, like, quite creative. I remember I got put in this, like, gifted and talented extracurricular group for art and design.
Yeah.
Which I really enjoyed. But then towards the end of, like, my school experience, I think, you know, some depression was seeping in as well. I became very demotivated. I remember one of my English teachers saying, well, just don't even bother really with the A-levels. You're going to get a D.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's so funny, actually, because my old school asked me to go in and, like, do a talk and do prize giving. And I'm like, only if I can see Miss... and give her a signed copy of the book, like, shout out Miss... said I was going to get a D in English in 2007. I don't forget.
You're like a literary Kill Bill.
Exactly.
Just working through your list of people to go give a signed copy of your book to.
You're still working it. I haven't forgotten.
Are you going to go back to school?
My plan is to probably like take part in their prize giving ceremony probably towards the end of this year when I've got a bit more time.
Right, okay.
My drama teacher when I was in sixth form, she could really see that I was flagging, I was failing, I was losing interest. And she was the one who, like, basically pulled me to a side And she was like, right, you're applying to university.
Right.
Because okay. I wasn't going to. And nobody else was looking out for me, basically. Nobody else was looking out for me.
Right.
And she was like, you're bright. You can do it. We are going to get you to apply.
Yeah.
She was like, you're going to do it. And I still need to go back to her and say thank you for that. Because yeah. I, you know, there were some family problems at home. My parents were consumed with arguing with one another. So they weren't right, really paying okay. attention. And there were also some teachers who were just like, oh, she's going to fail anyway, whatever. And so like,
I love how many times you said Miss
No. I'm not going to say, I hold a grudge.
I don't know if you're looking for an episode title, but I think we might have found it.
I think we've got it. I think we've got it. I remember in my English class, in my drama class, because I was quite creative, I love to write and I love to read. I never yeah. did the homework, but I enjoyed being involved in the creative things, I think particularly drama. There were clearly students who, I don't think it's coincidental that they were white. It was like the atmosphere amongst the teachers was like, this is the person we are going to channel all our energies into getting into Oxford.
Right, yeah.
Fuck
yeah,
everyone
yeah.
else, yeah. you know? Like, that was definitely the vibe that I was getting. And it was very clear that I wasn't one of those kids.
Right.
And I'm not saying I wanted to go to Oxbridge.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think just having an environment of people basically already giving up on you before you tried was very demotivating to me. And it's something I very much internalized by the time I was 17. Look, I'll never know my English teacher's true motivations for demoralising me. She may have been overworked and under-resourced. What I do know is how badly her words affected me. It's quite upsetting to think back to this time period in my life. And not just because I'm reminded of my own personal pain, but also because a decade later, I can see the bigger picture. I know I wasn't the only teenager left to languish at the wayside by the state education system. The evidence shows things are looking up, though. The government's long-term stats on this, focused on poorer pupils as a whole, show that what was once a drastic attainment gap between white and ethnic minority students is now rapidly shrinking. By the time my drama teacher intervened, I was almost past caring. But I took her advice and made it to university.
What did you study at uni?
I did English literature. So I ended up applying and getting into the University of Central Lancashire, which is in Preston.
Preston, right, okay.
In the northwest of England, which is a good 200 miles away from home.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And that's where I went. And I went to go and study English literature because I'd always loved reading and writing.
Yeah. So what's the experience of pitching up in Preston, 18-year-old Rennie?
Okay. Well, I had like two suitcases. And at this point, my little sister had been born. So right. my mum had to give up the store and money was in short supply in the family. So I remember like I had £60 in my pocket.
Wow.
Just tied me over until the student loan came in. And I just got off the train with two suitcases. I didn't really know I was going.
What's Preston like?
Well, it was much smaller. It was grey, rainy, as the Northwest is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you think London is bad. The first thing that I was struck by was just the intimate friendliness of people in the Northwest.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I remember getting off the train and I didn't really know where I was going because I hadn't put the time and energy into going around campuses. And my parents were consumed with their own stuff. So
right, yeah.
I got off and I had these two heavy suitcases and then this father and son duo, they had like red hair and freckles and they're like, oh, you're all right there. Like, do you know where you're going? I was like, no, not really. And they're just like, well, okay, we'll help you. And they just like found the campus for me. Yeah. I wish I could find them and be like, you know, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was the first day of the rest of my life. Ashley, you said, when did I realise that like racism was a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in Preston.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's a very white place.
Yeah.
You know, it's in between Liverpool and Manchester, two big, bustling, multicultural cities.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think the thing about this university is that there are a lot of people who go to that university from fairly rural areas of England.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of them have never really interacted with black people at all, yeah. ever. So I'm in halls with these people. And, you know, it was never anything completely overt, but there was just low-level ignorance.
Yeah.
I remember making friends with a Londoner who was white and was very keen to get in with a cool crowd.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget this. There was this like, there was a time when I heard him with some of the white people from rural areas. This guy was from East London, by the way.
Yeah.
Laughing at Paki jokes.
No.
And I was like, this is unforgivable from you.
What was your relationship with politics before uni?
I wasn't involved in politics really at all before I went to university.
Is there a specific reason? Was it just because you were at uni and you were just experiencing life? Or was there a specific reason that you got involved in political stuff?
I think in my second year I read Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex.
Right, okay.
So that was like a consciousness-raising text for me, you know, classic feminist text.
Yeah.
And that really got me thinking about the world and the way it's structured and power relationships and stuff.
Yeah.
And then also there was this, like, this is the Northwest in the late 2000s. So there was this, like, ever-present threat of the far right. Like, they were organizing and they were, like, fairly popular in the area at the time, and they would often do marches. And so that was something that really enraged me, especially, you know, I was learning about so much about the world, including the Nazis. And I was a bit like, wow, these guys are really trying to bring it back. Someone's got to do something about this.
What organisation was it? Was it?
It was the English
BNP?
Defence League.
That's the English Defence League. Right.
But at the same time, the British National Party's Nick Griffin had gone on Question Time.
I remember
And I remember that as well. That was a very formative moment for me, which is why I sort of discussed it in the book.
Yeah.
So that was like a background. And because I was paying a bit more attention in the world, I was paying attention to that and I was feeling very disturbed and distressed by it.
But that's amazing, because that means you're having this awakening about feminism and racial politics, kind of like, that's a lot to take.
Certainly, yes.
That's a lot of shit to lay on someone's door.
So I tried to get involved in it all, in opposing these things. I tried to get involved in all of them. And I remember after I finished reading Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex, I must have been about 19, I just went to Google and I Googled UK feminism.
Right.
And this website, the F word came up. And it had information about, like, you know, conferences and whatnot. I just found a way to go to them. I found myself traveling down to London and a lot. And what I found was, because of who was organizing these events, largely trade unions and stuff, they would actually pay for your travel sometimes.
Oh, right.
To help you just get there. So I was getting involved in these things and meeting people and then staying in contact with them online.
Yeah.
And because the community felt so small then, it wasn't long before, like, I met everybody.
Yeah.
You know? It's like 12 people. And then at the same time, I was busy trying to organise against the EDL campus. I remember me and the Student Left Network, which was the society I was chairing, we organised a Love Music Hate Racism event in the Student Union Bar and, like, raised loads of money.
So you're going on marches, really engaging with activism.
Mm.
And, like, I mean, in retrospect, your current career makes so much sense, because you're studying literature and then engaging in activism. You've sort of brought all of those things together. Was there a time when you were sort of engaged in activism that you thought, this sort of more active thing is what I'm going to do? Or was the writing always going on in the background?
Oh, the writing was part and parcel.
Right, yeah.
I was doing both.
Yeah.
I'd go on the march and blog about it. I'd blog about an issue and then find an activism thing to be involved in. So it was always, to me, those things were just one and the same.
There was a lot to react to back then. 2010 saw the election of a Conservative government. Then Prime Minister David Cameron used a key speech to declare that state multiculturalism had failed and argued that Britain's tolerance of other cultures was leading to extremism. It happened on the same day that the English Defence League protested in his constituency. This was an angle he repeated throughout his time as Prime Minister. He maintained that British values were the pillar of enlightenment and equality, almost always in opposition to other countries and cultures. This has always been difficult to hear as a person whose citizenship seemed constantly up for debate. So I tried to write through it. This is part one of a two-part episode. Next week, I'll discuss how I went from scrappy activist to scrappy published author. We're using the platform to signal boost other podcasters who are doing excellent work. This week, I'm shouting out the Receipts podcast. It's a podcast by women, for women, hosted by four hilarious women. It's about life and love and money and current affairs. You can listen to it on all good podcast apps. About Race with Rennie Edo-Lodge is written by me. It's produced by Renee Richardson. Our researcher is Res Marino, and our research assistant is Isis Thompson. Original music is by Matt Sidiso, and artwork is by Kevin Morosky. Additional help is provided by Laurie Kennedy. You can join in the conversation using the hashtag AboutRaceWithRenny. Full transcripts and episodes are available on our website, aboutracepodcast.com. This podcast is funded by Arts Council England.